60s.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And I don't have a good one for you right now, but I do have a question to start off with. Usually at this point, you hear some of my commentary on something, and I decided I had a few things to say about Kevin Coe, the notorious serial rapist from about 40 years ago. But then I got the opportunity to talk to the mayor of the Washington city that Kevin Coe was dropped on without any kind of warning. So what happens when the state of Washington Department of Corrections decides to drop a notorious serial rapist on your town out of prison after four decades and into your city without warning? I thought I'd ask that question straight to Auburn Mayor Nancy Backus, who joins me now. Mayor Backus, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So tell me this. You didn't get any warning from the Department of Corrections or law enforcement that Kevin Coe, the South Hill rapist from Spokane from so many decades ago, was going to be put in your community?
I had no idea until yesterday.
Wow. How did you come to find out?
Well, we found out through the media, quite frankly. Actually, it was not yesterday. I believe it was the evening before. We found out through the media that he was in Auburn.
Even though he was released about a week ago on the 2nd of October.
Right.
Yeah.
I did not have any knowledge of that until media had made it aware, had made me aware of it.
I mean, should communities routinely be told if somebody who's ranked as a level 3 sex offender, the most likely to go out and commit more sexual crimes, that's what level 3 means, should communities get some kind of warning?
I believe they absolutely should. There should have been so many different lines of communication, especially warning. It appears that Federal Way, where he was going to be placed initially, had about a month's warning that he may be moving there on October 2nd. But we did not get that type of advance warning. And we are working very closely with the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe because the location where Mr. Coe is residing currently is on reservation property. So we are working very closely with the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe at this point to see if between our two jurisdictions there's anything that can be done.
Do you have any idea, Mayor Backus, why they didn't put him in Federal Way? And was it because they gave them advanced warning and Federal Way said, we don't want that guy in our community?
Well, I think there was a significant amount of backlash, yes, from the community when he was going to the facility in Federal Way. And so there was a pivot to move to a backup location in Auburn.
I want to ask you this, Mayor Backus, because oftentimes as a reporter, I'd ask politicians like you, I'd ask them questions, and I felt like sometimes they felt they could answer honestly. But do you think that the reason he's been dropped in your community without warning is because when they did give a community warning, the community objected and said, you're not sending him here. So they said, what? Fine, we'll just drop him in somebody's town without warning the town. Do you think that's what happened?
Well, that certainly is not out of the realm of possibility. And then, you know, my other frustration is, why here? Why South King County? For a long time, it have felt like anything that the rest of the county didn't want was dumped in South King County. And, you know, I don't understand why King County to begin with. It's not Mr. Coe's original county of residence.
Nope.
And it just feels like, once again, South King County is getting dumped on, and it's just not appropriate, and I'm very angry.
I would be as well. And Mayor Backus, I have to tell you, I usually tell my audience if I have a dog in the fight, if I have some, you know, possible bias. Kevin Coe raped a co-worker of mine who I thought very well of, a young lady who worked at the radio station where I worked at in Spokane. And I heard about his crime from her, and then have talked to her over the years because she went on to become an advocate for women who have survived a sexual assault. Yeah. And I thought she was very good at it. And this, you know, so it's a bit personal in that, you know, when one of your friends and coworkers ends up being attacked by a guy. So if somebody says, Lars, you're not unbiased in this. No, I'm not unbiased. I'm also not unbiased about rapists. I think he should have spent the rest of his life in prison.
No.
And I'm still wondering why.
Well, I couldn't agree more with you. I mean, I'm old enough to remember watching it on the news when it was occurring, and just seeing the look on his face as he's walking down the hallways in the courthouse, just, it was a look of just, it doesn't matter, right? And of arrogance. And I just don't think time can erase that. And yes, he's 78 years old now, I understand. But there was also comment that he is wheelchair bound, and from some of the information I received yesterday, he is not wheelchair bound, which really concerns me a great deal, that the full truth is not being shared, and my community deserves to know who is in their town, and we should also have the opportunity to say whether he should be in our town or not. And I'm not trying to say we need to push him off to another city. That's not what I'm saying, but there needs to be better communication and understanding of what is going to be expected of the community and what the community can expect for support. And that did not happen, and I will fight to make sure that this never happens again to any community, and how we can make sure that Mr. Coe doesn't stay in our community.
Mayor Backus, have you reached out to, say, the governor's office or the Department of Corrections to say, why did you do it this way, and will you change the way you're doing this in the future?
That is my plan. In fact, right now, we've been gathering documents this morning to see who was involved in this from the beginning. We have some of the documentation just off online. Of the judges that were involved in the decision, the Honorable Julie McKay, Judge of Superior Court. He was tried in Spokane, so all of the post-trial hearings, I understand, were there as well. And on October 2nd is when the motion was granted to dismiss, and the petitioner was the state of Washington, saying that he was no longer a threat to the community.
Mayor Backus, I appreciate you coming on. That is the mayor of Auburn, Washington, Nancy Backus. No warning that a notorious rapist, Kevin Coe, has been released, dropped into her community with no warning. When he was going to go to Federal Way, apparently Federal Way said, not here, so they sent him to another town with no warning. Do you think anybody thinks that's the appropriate way to go? And do you think the neighbor, maybe the governor of Washington, Ferguson, should have something to say about that?
Finally agree with Chuck Schumer?
Of course there's some wasteful spending, but you don't use a meat axe and cut everything.
Pass out the chainsaws and welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And I got my-
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, the numbers tell the tale. Oregon and Washington rank as some of the best states in America to be a teacher, and some of the worst if you're a student. Fat paychecks and pensions, bottom ranking for reading and math. Does that add up? Both states have doubled spending on schools in the past decade, while test scores have dropped like a rock. You know who's getting it right? Mississippi. I know, reputationally, Mississippi is one of them backward states. They are far outspent by blue states like Oregon and Washington. But in the last decade, Mississippi has gone from the bottom of the American educational pile to the top. And the solution ain't rocket science. Students get tested in third grade. If they're not ready, they get held back for a year. Students get tutoring. And if the tutoring works, then they advance to fourth grade. $18,000 a year in Oregon per student per year for K-12 education. $19,000 in the state of Washington. That's tuition for ducks and huskies. Well, ducks and huskies pay far less than that per year. But you have to understand how failure benefits the teachers and Democrat politicians. Failing teachers' unions then demand bigger paychecks, and they almost always get them. Unions then fund political contributions, and those go exclusively to the Democrats. And your kids get to pay the price. Glad to have you with me on a Thursday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day today, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Scott writes in, Lars, I was listening to that guy, Jerry, the naysayer who called your show. I think that was his name. He got frustrated and did as I predicted. He called you names. He can't deal with reality. There's not a whole lot you can do with that kind of individual. You are doing your best to reason with him. This is one of the limitations of talk radio. There's no time to really get into somebody's past and find out what makes them tick. That is the million-dollar question. How do you present reality in a consumable form to Jerry? Signed, Scott. Well, the question is answered this way. I love having naysayers call in, because if you tell people out there, yeah, there are folks who believe that America is an evil nation. It's not, but they believe it. They believe that the best way to prosperity is by raising taxes and letting government get as big as it possibly can. It's not, but that's what they believe. In other words, naysayers call in with all kinds of crazy things. I want you to hear what they have to say, so you know there are people out there who actually think that nonsense. And then I want you to hear how I respond to it, whether it's with questions or something else. In Jerry's case, he got angry because, well, he said things about Donald Trump. And he said that Donald Trump was a liar. I said, tell me the favorite lie that you've heard from Donald Trump. And he stammered and he stuttered and he couldn't figure out what to say, because that's all they know is a bumper sticker. Trump's a fascist. Trump's a liar. Trump's this. Trump's that. Except if you actually ask them one simple question, like, give me an example, they're not going to have an answer to that. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Today's Daily Grill goes to the Washington State Department of Corrections and the entire judicial system for taking a notorious serial rapist who was convicted of three different rapes and dropping him on a Northwest community, in this case Auburn, Washington, without any warning to the community. Kevin Coe, although old and infirm, is ranked by the shrinks as a sex offender three. That means they think that he is the most likely kind of sex offender to commit more sexual crimes, and imagine having that dropped on your community. Our best email of the day so far, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They did it for me. It's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Bruce writes in from Kirkland, Washington. Lars, I'm getting tired of the animals used to represent our major political parties. The elephant for Republicans is fine, but it needs to be tougher. Put some long, sharp tusks on that fella. Give him a serious demeanor, even a scowl. And for the Democrats, the donkey has to go. Donkeys are strong and do heavy work without complaint. They stand up to harsh conditions. Democrats, they whine because you use the wrong pronoun or poke fun at them with a hilarious AI meme. Dems need a new animal. My choice would be fainting goats, but they're too cute. Perhaps you can poll your listeners as to what species embodies all of that, that is the modern Democrat Party. Enjoy the show as Bruce Hay in Kirkland, Washington. Bruce, thanks very much. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Let's go to George. Hey, George, welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. What's on your mind?
Hi there, Lars. Secretary Kennedy had a few choice words to say about the hiring of Bad Bunny for the Super Bowl, and I have a few choice words to say to Secretary Kennedy. First of all, in case Secretary Kennedy missed the history lesson, the Hispanics people came here first on the Mayflower, but on the Nina and Pinta and Santa Maria. Those were all filled with Hispanic people guided by
Christopher Columbus.
So the Spanish people were here first in the first place. In the second place, I can think of about five states right off the top of my head, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas, which were all part of Mexico prior to becoming American states. So the Spanish heritage in America runs deep. Third of all, the Spanish population in the United States, speaking Spanish, population in the United States is some 55 million people, which makes the United States the second largest Spanish-speaking country in the world, larger than Spain and only behind Mexico.
Okay, let me ask you something. Did Kennedy object? See, I haven't followed that controversy that closely. I didn't find it that interesting. But are they objecting to Bad Bunny because he's Spanish or Latino, whatever you want to call it? Or are they objecting because of the content?
They're objecting because he's speaking in Spanish. What I heard...
Well, we are a predominantly English-speaking country, and English really is the official language of this country, isn't it?
Yes, but it's not the only language in this country. And this is America. You should be free to speak in whatever language you wish to speak in.
Unless you want to communicate to the entire population, in which case, shouldn't you speak the predominant language? I mean, you can go to any part of Western Europe. I bet there are lots of Germans that speak English. But if you want to be understood by the German people, would you speak to them in English?
I would speak to them in German.
Right. And so shouldn't Bad Bunny be talking to America in English?
Well, the problem is the Super Bowl is no longer an American event per se. It's become a worldwide phenomenon. And Bugs Bunny is a worldwide act. He's famous worldwide. And he draws people to see the NFL game. Eyes that wouldn't normally watch the NFL game from all over the world.
You know what? I somehow avoided talking about Taylor Swift for the last couple of years, and I've also avoided talking about Bad Bunny just because I don't find it that interesting. But, George, you took me to a new and different place, and for that I appreciate it. 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go first on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Senator John Kennedy with some advice to Schumer and Hakeem.
Chuck and Hakeem need to go to Amazon, buy some testicles, and stand up to the moon wing of their party.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to tell you about something that may not affect that many people. It might be a couple of million people across the entire country. But it has to do with the 08 financial collapse. And I think that all of us were affected by the 08 financial collapse, although I don't have a direct dog in the fight here. But there were people who had either mortgage loans or second loans on their homes, you know, so-called HELOCs. And they borrowed the money, and then 08 happened. The economy ran off the edge of a cliff, and they couldn't make the payments. So they went to the bank in many cases and said, hey, I can't make the payments. And the bank said, effectively, well, we're not going to chase you for the money anymore. And some of those loans were actually fully forgiven, and then people had to pay taxes on the value that they were given by that loan being forgiven. But some of those loans, even though the bank and the creditors stopped chasing you, the loans are still there. And now there are private entities that are going out and buying up those loans for pennies on the dollar, literally. You know, a $100,000 loan bought for $2,000, that kind of thing. And what's happening now is folks are showing up to collect on the loan and knocking on the door or ringing the bell or sending an email saying, you have to pay all this money. And if you're not ready to pay it or make payment arrangements, you're going to lose the house you're currently living in. I thought I would check in with our friend Nick Shivers, who's one of the many great supporters of this program. He's got the real estate business, the Shivers team. Nick, welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be here, Lars.
You know, I hadn't even thought about this, but, you know, I assumed that when people got loan forgiveness, that the forgiveness was going to be total. But then you alerted me that you were well aware of this and that there were people who thought they had, you know, they didn't have the creditor ringing their phone anymore, but the loan still exists out there and somebody can buy it.
Yeah. Back in 2008, I had a company called Home Savers that we actually negotiated like full settlements. And I think the biggest issue is people thought that there was a thing called the 1099-C. And that was a forgiveness of debt under the Bush-Obama Debt Forgiveness Act. But that was not a lien release or a reconveyance satisfaction. So unless, like, let's say someone did a short sale and they said, oh, great, I got the 1099, the Debt Forgiveness Act, settled that for me. No, the fact is the bank, if they didn't negotiate a reconveyance or the full satisfaction, that debt was still out there, even though they didn't have to pay any taxes on the money that they got released. So that is why you're seeing this come back up. And there was really two types of loans. There was the HELOC, and I would guess the majority of those HELOCs are the ones that are coming around because they had a longer maturity date than a second, because seconds, most of those would have matured like in 2012 with a 6 to 10 year lifespan. So we would be past most of those. It's the HELOCs that are now probably popping up, Lars, and it could be a very shocking and a very devastating financial hit for someone.
Well, by the way, just for people who don't know the terminology, HELOC is home equity line of credit. So people would have a mortgage on their house and they'd have a bunch of equity and they wanted to borrow some money and put a new roof on the house or go on vacation or whatever they plan to do with the money. And they would take out a home equity line of credit. And when the 08 financial collapse happened, a lot of people were unable to pay those. And you're saying that those had longer maturity dates, meaning the surprise is coming at the end of the maturity date, and that's what these buyers are buying, is they're buying up HELOCs and then showing up on somebody's doorstep and saying, you owe all this money, pay up or you may be out of your house. And there have been literally in the last couple of months people forced out of their homes, right?
Yeah, that is correct. And the majority of those HELOCs were brought out between 2004 and 2008. So really what that gives you is a mature date of 2019 to 2025. And then there's a time depending on what state they're in. Like the Northwest is usually 6 to 10 years after maturity. So that is why those HELOCs are being crunched up and sold off. Now, kind of some things that you would want to do is if this happens, and this would just be a tremendous, terrible thing, is you number one, you have to demand the debt validation, and then you want to look at the chain of life, and then
Now, hold on. Does that mean you've got to see the actual paperwork? Because some of these companies have made demands of folks, and then when the people are smart enough to say, I want to see that you've actually got the paper that says I owe this money, that all of a sudden the company says, well, we don't actually have the paper. We're just going to demand the money from you. At that point, that may get you out, right?
Exactly. And the one thing you got to be real careful is because if you like make it, let's say they, you know how sometimes these creditors are, they get on the phone and they try to talk you into paying a partial payment. If you make a partial payment without getting something in writing saying that they're going to stop whatever they're doing, you could actually extend their maturity time frame. So,
oh my God. I mean, so somebody who says, you pay us $1,000 now and we'll give you a lot more room, we'll give you another year to settle this up, the $1,000 just extends the deadline for years, perhaps?
Yes, for years. That's why if that happens, you probably need to talk to a housing or consumer attorney immediately after you validate this debt.
Okay, so let me ask you something, Nick. I always am in favor of people being very proactive. If you owe money to somebody, get to the creditor now and try to get it taken care of now. If somebody thinks, well, yeah, we did have a HELOC, and yeah, it kind of went away in 2008 or 2009 or 2010, and we assumed it was gone, is there any way to check and find out whether that thing is still a ticking time bomb out there or not?
Yeah, if for some reason, let's say it was a second mortgage, you could just get a title search on your own if this was your house, because most of them were probably not, the HELOCs weren't necessarily attached to a house specifically, it was a full lien. But if someone said, hey, no, it's on your house, you could have went back to see, hey, when we did the short sale, because most of them, Lars, would have been a short sale. Because remember, a non-judicial foreclosure that happens a lot in Oregon and Washington back then would have been they wouldn't be able to come after him then, because that was in the documents on the foreclosure. This would be someone that settled, they stayed in their house, they were able to sell their house or stay in it with a negotiation. And that is where that full reconveyance satisfaction would have come in. Let's say I had $1 million house. I owed $1 million on it. Market crashed. I sold it for $500. If I did not get a full reconveyance and I only got the 1099-C, yeah, I didn't have to pay the taxes on that other $500,000. But if I didn't get the full reconveyance or satisfaction, then somebody goes out and buys that loan for pennies on the dollar, then technically I'm still responsible for that amount.
And that's true even if you don't own the house anymore, right?
That is correct. Because it goes to the person, not the house.
So if you think you might be looking down the barrel of one of those, don't wait till the folks call you up on the phone. And for God's sake, don't make a partial payment right now, because that only makes the problem worse, right?
Yeah, do not ignore those type of things, and you see it all the time. You don't want to deal with it, but you have to deal with it head on. But don't take their word for it. They are not your friends if they're creditors on the line. They are not your friends, and do not do anything without talking to a housing or consumer attorney.
Quick question, Nick. What do you think about the morality of buying these loans on pennies on the dollar and then turning around and saying, we want the full amount?
Dirty. It's dirty.
That's my impression as well. That's Nick Shivers from the Nick Shivers team. He's one of the supporters of this program. But when I saw this, I thought, you're talking about 600,000 to 1 million Americans who are looking down the barrel potentially of having a creditor call you up and say, pay up right now, or you may be out on the street living in a refrigerator box. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey guys, you're
Tim Walz, proving fashion really is political.
Think of how easy it would be to be a damn Republican. What should I wear today? This stupid freaking red hat.
Now, with his red hat, here's Lars Larson.
Red are tiny homes, needles urban art. Downtown's got that OG urban charm, and it's all part of Portland's heart. We got compassion painted on plywood doors and a mayor who calls it vision. If the road's blocked off by protest lines, well, that's part of our condition. Cause everything's fine in Portland. No crisis here to see. The smoke's just part of the skyline. The rats are community.
Fine.
Welcome back to the Lawrence Larson Show. This is one of the reasons I love my audience, is that somebody went out and wrote that song and had it produced, probably with a little AI help, and that's all right. Portland's just fine. And as I understand it, it's available on Spotify and a bunch of other places. We'll try and post it up on our website as well. But welcome back to the program on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you want to join what we've always called the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Now, our X poll today takes a little bit of explanation, but not much. Should convicted criminals behind bars in Oregon get taxpayer-funded Medicaid insurance? And if you say, Lars, I thought that was illegal under federal law. It is illegal under federal law, and yet the state of Oregon, under Governor Kotek, Governor Kotek asked Joe Biden last year, 2024, said, can we have permission to sign up convicted criminals who are still behind bars but are due to get out in 6 months or a year or whatever? Can we sign them up for Medicaid? I'm sure the taxpayers won't mind one little bit if we sign them up for taxpayer-funded health insurance. And, of course, the Joe Biden administration, or somebody, whoever was running the auto pen that day, said, sure, Oregon, go ahead, do that, even though it violates federal law for obvious reasons. Why would you want to take somebody who's already costing the taxpayers about $30,000 a year for three hots and a cot, sitting behind bars for having committed a crime? Why in the world would you want to benefit them by signing them up for Medicaid? For medical insurance paid for by the taxpayers that is intended for the poor. And you know what the explanation was? The Department of Corrections in Oregon, which is so freaking liberal that they won't even call them convicts or inmates anymore. In all official documents, they are referred to as adults in custody. They don't even call them criminals anymore. They are adults in custody. And they said, well, we're worried that when we finally let these criminals back out into the communities where they committed their crimes, that they might have to go a couple of months before they got signed up for medical insurance. And we want them to hit the community running. We want them to be able to go to the hospital or the doctor or get a prescription or any of that. And we don't want them to have any trouble. Don't you wish the state government spent as much time and effort trying to, you know, serve citizens who don't commit crimes as it does trying to serve citizens who do commit crimes? So our question today, should convicted criminals behind bars get taxpayer-funded Medicaid insurance? My answer to that is no. The federal law's answer to that is no. The Donald Trump administration's answer is no. The answer from President Otto Penn and Governor Kotek is, oh, no, we want to give lots and lots of things paid for by the taxpayers away to convicted criminals, otherwise known as adults in custody. Today's X poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. Ultimate Truck Services, if you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let me go first to Ronald. Hey, Ronald, welcome to the program, and thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was just reading. I got my voters pamphlet. I was reading about the A201 voters.
I'm not aware. Ron, I haven't read mine yet. What is the A201?
It is to guarantee long-term care funds for their when we need them.
Oh, they Washington buy, cares. This is Washington doesn't give a damn. If you want to get rid of it, get rid of it, because the Washington Cares program is a giant scam on workers. It's a tax that applies. If it is the Washington Cares program, it's a tax that applies to almost everyone, will probably benefit very, very few people. And unless you're fairly wealthy, it's not going to do you much good at all. But that would be my answer on A201. Let's go to Duncan. Hey, Duncan, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Yeah, I'm on the East Coast. My brother and my niece, my brother's an IU grad, so of course he's flying out there, the two of them, to go to the big game at Oregon on Saturday.
Yeah.
But I'm telling my brother, he has got to be insane to fly into Portland. I mean, President Trump has said it's like a war zone. It's worse than Kabul. And that all the stores are boarded up. You can't even go to a store. I mean, I'm telling my brother, like, you got to be insane to go to Portland. Like, you're there. Like, would you agree?
Yes, it's a dangerous place. The crime, they say the crime is down. They said that after they got rid of an already defunded police department and made it even smaller, stopped gathering as many statistics. Most people in the city don't bother calling the police unless it's a major crime because they know they're not going to get any attention from the police. And, of course, there are regular protests and riots. People get hurt on mass transit because the criminals have discovered that mass transit is a great place to go after victims. So, Duncan, give him fair warning before he comes. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. We've always called Thursdays Conspiracy Theory Thursdays, and the reason we decided to do that a long, long time ago is that it seemed like Thursday was the day I'd always get calls or emails from people with one conspiracy theory or another. But as you know, since we've seen a couple of decades of conspiracy theories then turning into actual fact, like, you know, the conspiracy about Russia, and we said that's a hoax, and they said, no, no, that's a conspiracy theory. It's really Russia messing with the election. No, it's not. It's a hoax, and it turned out to be right. Or the conspiracy theory that said it was a virus lab in China that originated COVID. And people said that's a crazy conspiracy theory, except now we know it's fact, et cetera. You can give thousands of examples of this kind of thing happening. So what happens in a given state when the state decides to make fuel a whole lot more expensive? And you say, well, consumers who drive their cars. No, no, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about food. Food basically comes from fuel. Fertilizer is made from natural gas. Diesel is what plants the crops. Diesel is what moves the livestock around. Electricity is what pumps the water out of the ground, things like that. If you make energy much more expensive, then food is going to become more expensive. And then what happens when the government decides to cut the water off to the farmers? Well, that's kind of a game changer, isn't it? I thought I'd talk to Dylan Honkoop because, Dylan, your name immediately came to mind because you're with Save Family Farming. When I read that, and this is the word, and I'll give credit, Washington's State Standard wrote, all surface water rights holders in the Yakima River Basin will see their water curtailed due to lack of available water. And apparently this is the first time this has ever happened. Welcome to the program. And what should we make of that?
This is a bad, bad situation, Lars. And it's already, I mean, a drought isn't something that happens overnight. And we've been seeing this coming now for months. What's crazy is it has shown the ineptitude of our state government, not only in what's been happening on the ground in the last few weeks, but in the fact that they haven't prepared us and made a way for us to prepare for this for many, many years, for decades. This didn't have to be this way. But instead of preparing that community, building the reservoirs, doing the infrastructure work that we needed to do, instead they spent decades fighting in court in the Yakima Basin. So now we're basically behind the eight ball on this for farmers in that region and for fish. And they were trying to work together, trying to make things work, but only after the state finally got out of the way. And that's the big problem. That's the elephant in the room here is our Washington State Department of Ecology and its absolute ineptitude in dealing with all of this.
Well, and funny, because, Dylan, I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't admit that for decades I've been complaining about California, which is always talking about being short of water. And they've had, over the decades, they've had literally dozens, a couple of dozen water projects on the drawing board. And then the voters voted to put billions of dollars to build them. And then the folks who run the state said, yeah, we're not going to build reservoirs, even though there are years where California has so much water, they don't know what to do with it. And those years would actually supply them with water all the way through the drought. Oregon and Washington are no different. They could take the same advantage of a notoriously rainy region. I mean, even on the eastern side of the mountains, and this is the Yakima Valley, Yakima River Basin, they could say, when it rains, let's hang on to it. And then when it's dry, we'll have a lot to carry us through the dry times. But you're telling me that the state of Washington, I mean, it's one thing if the crazy environmental groups go out and fight it, but when the state aids and abets them, they're creating the problem, aren't they?
The problem started back in the 70s. They filed a court case to adjudicate, that's the term, it was an adjudication of water rights in this Yakima Basin. Instead of providing a pathway for everybody involved, the tribes concerned about the fish, the farmers, of course, concerned about food, the cities, everybody that needs water, instead of providing a way for them to work together and build this infrastructure that they now so desperately need, they spent 30 years fighting in this court process called an adjudication before everyone got so frustrated that they finally came together and said, let's figure this out. It happened over a tailgate in a parking lot. A couple of guys who were supposed to be at loggerheads said, no, a tribal guy, a farmer guy got together and said, let's do this. So they've been working on this. They were prepared for this, but they're 20, 30 years behind where they could have been if the state wouldn't have been in the way with this crazy litigation in the first place. That's what's going on here. But what's doubly crazy here is that the State Department of Ecology, they're the ones telling us we're supposed to be so worried about this. They're the ones apparently pulling the trigger on curtailing water. It's actually the farmers and the tribes working together now in that basin who are ahead of the game. They had a plan. They've been dialing things back. They've been managing this resource. This happens. We have droughts. And it was the State Department of Ecology that got caught with their pants down. They weren't actually enforcing what they were supposed to be. And that's the hidden story underneath all of this that people haven't heard, is that it's actually ecology that, even though they beat the drum about how we got to stay water all the time, when it came down to brass tacks, they literally told staff that it was too big of a job and they wouldn't be able to do it. So how are we supposed to trust an agency that says we're supposed to save water when it actually comes down to it? They aren't actually even able to do what they're legally required to do.
And by the way, Dylan, I'm going to pull an example from Oregon, but I think the two states are, you know, they're political cousins. They behave the same way. You know, if Oregon does something one year, Washington does it the next year and vice versa. Just this week, the governor of the state of Oregon said, hey, we got to get all this federal money for green projects, and Trump is cutting it off, and we have to get these projects underway. So she wrote an executive order saying we're going to change all the permitting processes just to get all these renewable projects through. And I thought, well, if you can do that for green energy, for windmills and solar panels, could you do that for water projects? You know, could the governor or the legislature say, you know, we're tired of sitting here tied up in court for years. We need to build some water projects. Let's get these things done. And that's what they're doing it in the case of Kotec of Oregon. She's doing it because she wants to glom onto all this federal cash that she loses out on if the solar panels or the windmills aren't under construction or on their way to being installed by July 4th of next year. But they could do this same thing with water projects, saying water is critical. It's critical to food. It's critical to people. Let's get this stuff done. Let's cut through the red tape and do it. They're choosing not to do it. Would you agree or not?
That's exactly right. And they're telling us it's about saving the fish. Well, if it's about saving the fish, then look at what a reservoir, even in some cases, the right kind of dam managed in the right spot, can do to actually save the fish, and they're standing in the way of that. So really, who is the problem?
Because if you've got that reservoir, when they talk about all this stuff about minimum stream flows, what happens when a river goes down to rock bottom? Well, the fish either die or they have tremendous difficulty. If, on the other hand, you have a reservoir saying, well, we've got some extra water we saved from a rainy year, we could use it now to make sure the fish have enough water. They could be doing this. They're not doing it. And now in Yakima, they're saying, we're going to cut the water off. Sorry. Too bad. We don't have enough storage, so we're running short because of politicians in Olympia and primarily in Seattle. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
naysayers go to the head of the line at the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You know what the liberals are afraid of right now? They're afraid that the Insurrection Act is going to be employed by President Trump to deploy federal troops without the approval of governors of the 50 states. And that hasn't happened since the 1990s, but it did happen in the 90s. In fact, it's happened a number of times over the decades. So why are they afraid of that? Because they understand that the president has some pretty broad authority. Let me get into the details of that and then tell you a little bit about what happened when the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem showed up, and she has gone out to Portland. She has gone to other places around the country and looked at the conditions on the ground, and she declares some of the local leadership to be liars. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, you go right to the head of the line at Lars Larson Show on X and on our website at LarsLarson.com. So what has happened now? The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco today was hearing from attorneys on both sides about what matter, about the idea that Donald Trump would activate the National Guard. He's already sent the National Guard in to help in Washington, D.C. It cleaned up a lot of Washington, D.C.'s crime problem. He has said that he will send the National Guard to Chicago. That has not happened yet, although it appears to be in the offing. And he has said, I will activate the National Guard, which he did, and I will send them to Portland, Oregon. And then a federal judge said, no, you won't. I'm putting a temporary hold on your deployment of those troops. This has gone to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, not exactly a federal appeals court that I have a lot of confidence in, but maybe I'm going to have to change that, because guess what we've heard about already today? The judges on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals heard the case today, heard the arguments from both sides, and here's the reporting from San Francisco. The appeals court panel indicated in its questioning that the president has sweeping authority. Well, that's bad news for the people who don't want to have the National Guard come in. I mean, I do. I want to see it happen. But the appeals court panel says, hey, first of all, the president has some pretty broad authority to do that. And then the reporting says they also question whether the judiciary, meaning the judges and the courts, even has the authority to put limitations on National Guard deployments if the president believes it is necessary. Now, if they're already asking questions and indicating, you know, he's got a lot of authority to do this, and do we even have the authority to tell him he can't? Because I've pointed out to you, National Guard has been used in Mississippi, it's been used in Alabama, and in the case of President Eisenhower, he sent the 101st Airborne Active Duty Military into Arkansas. And if you say, well, Lars, that happened decades ago, but the situation is very much the same. What happened in Arkansas? A governor named Orville Faubus, who said, you're not going to send those black kids to school in our white kid school. They're not allowed in that school. And Eisenhower said, no, they are allowed in that school. And if you don't do it on your own, I'm going to send the 101st Airborne. Well, Trump hasn't yet threatened to use the 101st Airborne, although maybe he should. Maybe that would get the attention of the liberals. And when they take it before a federal appeals court, even one that knows that it gets overturned all the time by the U.S. Supreme Court, and even the judges in San Francisco say, yeah, I think he's got a lot of authority to do this, and we're not even sure we have the authority. And if you think about it from in terms of the Constitution, I mean, any school kid knows we have three branches of the federal government. You've got the legislative, Capitol Hill, not worth much these days, but you've got Capitol Hill. You've got the judiciary, that's the Supreme Court and all the federal courts below it. And then, of course, you have the executive. Now, do you think if you had even a passing familiarity with the U.S. Constitution that you'd say, well, any time a judge doesn't like what the president is doing, that judge, one out of 700 or so federal judges, has the authority to tell the president, you're not allowed to do this. In other words, you have one president who can act as the executive, and you have 700 veto votes that are lurking out there in every corner of America. That is not the way the system is supposed to work. Constitution makes that clear. It's why most federal judges only have authority within their own federal district. And then you've got the visit of Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to Portland, and she sat down and talked with the cops. She talked to the mayor. She talked to the governor. And you know what she concluded? She concluded they're all a pack of liars. And if you think I'm overstating what she says, Kristi Noem, Secretary Kristi Noem, showed up at a cabinet meeting with President Trump today and said this right to President Trump's face.
And then I was in Portland, went out and back on Tuesday, and met with the governor, met with the mayor, met with the chief of police and the superintendent of the highway patrol. They are all lying and disingenuous and dishonest people, because as soon as you leave the room, then they make the exact opposite response. So we're looking at new facilities to purchase. They're in Portland, too, and we're going to double down. And I told them if they didn't meet our demands for safety and security on the streets and work with us, then we were going to bring in more federal law enforcement.
In fact, she said that they would quadruple the amount of federal law enforcement, which the president unquestionably has the authority to do. I mean, they may argue about whether or not he can activate the National Guard and send them anywhere in America he wants to, but there's no debate that if he tells the federal marshals and the FBI and Customs and Border Protection and ICE and all the other federal agencies he controls, you go out there and you straighten these folks out. So what are the liberals afraid of? The Insurrection Act, and they are all chattering about it today. Well, the Insurrection Act says, in the case of, quote, unlawful obstructions, combinations, or assemblages against the government that make it impracticable to enforce the law through normal means, presidents can deploy federal troops and use them, quote, as he considers necessary to enforce those laws or to suppress rebellion. So, he wants to enforce the law. The law has been used 30 times over the course of U.S. history. So about once every 10 years. And while most recently, 1992, the riots in Los Angeles, it was invoked, the last time it was invoked without a state governor asking for it was in the 60s. So most of the time, the governors have enough sense to say, we got a problem and we need some help. So in this case, the governor, the mayor, the chief of police, the state patrol, well, as Kristi Noem says, they're lying. The minute you leave the room, they change their story. On that note, let's go to naysayer Ben. Hey, Ben, welcome to the program. What do we disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Well, Lars, I just, you know, I have to finally call and give you a difference of opinion. As a blue-collar worker that lives and works in Portland every day of my life, I have since I've been 17 years old.
You're burning a lot of daylight. You're going to run out of time. Make your point.
Yeah, no problem, Lars. I am. I'm telling you it's not a war zone. I'm telling you, you want to believe it's a war zone because that fits your guys' agenda. Trump and
so when people come to the ICE headquarters and they attack the building with explosives, with fireworks, with lasers, with rocks, they force the building to be boarded up, and that's not creating a war zone, a one-block war zone.
You're only hearing what people are saying.
No, I'm seeing what I see. I've been down in that neighborhood, Ben. I've seen it, and I've seen the videos of what goes on there and has gone on for the last 3 months. Have you seen those?
I have seen it, Lars. I live it. I was just off of McAdam. I live it. I just ran in a marathon Sunday by Friday.
And you don't consider that a problematic situation where federal law enforcement cannot operate because of the mob outside that are not protesters, they are rioters. Ben, I appreciate a good naysayer.
The Lars Larson Show. Exercising the right to free speech every day. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, it turns out that big technology's AI, artificial intelligence chatbots, are picking sides, and they're not being subtle about it at all. Should we trust tools like ChatGPT, Meta AI, and Grok when they blame Republicans for past and present government shutdowns? Thought we'd talk with David Bozell. David serves as the president of the Media Research Center, and he's very familiar to my audience. David, welcome back.
Mr. Larson, thank you for having me.
That's Lars. What is going on here? Because, you know, if you want technology to be somewhat agnostic, that is AI in theory, I'm not crazy about AI, and I think it has some really terrible implications we probably haven't even imagined yet. But having said that, So now AI is taking sides on things like the government shutdown. How's that happening?
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. Yeah, our Free Speech America team here at MRC, we asked all the different, popular AI chatbots. We asked them the same question. Answer in one word, who is more responsible for the current 2025 government shutdown, Republicans or Democrats? And all of them, ChatGPT, Meta AI, and X is Grok, believe it or not, all blamed Republicans for the 2025 shutdown. And they just cite Democrat-friendly outlets like NPR, PBS, which are still among us, at least for the time being, temporarily. And Wikipedia as their sources. So it's pretty. It's pretty egregious. Now, I understand the for those of us who are let's say tech savvy and AI savvy. Look, these things can be responsive. I could scold it, right? I could tell Grok not to be so liberal. Find other sources. I could tell ChatGPT the same thing. Stop being so liberal. Find other sources. And in most cases, it'll do that.
You can correct it yourself, but that's not the point. You expect it to be neutral when you ask a neutral question, who's to blame, right?
Exactly right. And this is and we went back and asked it who it blamed for past shutdowns. The most egregious was the 2013 shutdown in which all of them basically lambasted the Republican Party and said that the Republican Party was shutting down the government because of Planned Parenthood and trying to take away abortion rights from women across the country. So it was really nasty about past shutdowns. And not much better about this one either. The oddity is the Washington Post has been more neutral about the government shutdown this week than some of these newfangled AI tools. Here in the hotbed of government, of the federal government apparatus, the Washington Post, believe it or not, has been pretty good about this shutdown, calling the Affordable Care Act not affordable at all, and never has been. And this week, it continued today, Lars, in which it said, let me make sure I just totally get it right here, in which it said that the government, quote, this is from the Washington Post editorial page. The government is too big. There is plenty of fat to cut. Can you imagine the Washington Post saying that?
I can't. So
you and I went through the Obamacare wars.
Yep.
And the passage of and the potential repeal of and the potential replace of. And thank you very much, John McCain, for not giving us that opportunity. Can you imagine being in 2010? Right. And being able to take a time machine to 2025, grabbing a Washington Post editorial and shoving it in the Democrats' face and saying, by the way, in 15 years, the Washington Post is going to say, and I quote, the Affordable Care Act was never actually affordable. I mean, it's killed me all week long that they've done that.
I mean, my audience expects me to be partisan, and I just say, yeah, this is who I am, and I'm going to tell you what I think and why I think it. But when I've had a few people try to argue, well, who's to blame? And I said, well, let's see. We have a bill to fund the government. It is passed the House of Representatives. I believe the House vote was bipartisan, barely. And then it goes to the Senate, and it gets a bipartisan vote, a couple of Democrats and some independents. They voted for it. It got 55, five votes short. So if you're saying who's to blame, why didn't the bill pass? I said because 45 Democrats voted against it, and a bipartisan group, including some Democrats, but mostly Republicans, voted for it. I would say the Democrats. Yep. And then you say, well, are the Republicans, did they offer something that was all larded up with all their pet projects and fun things? No. They said this is basically the same budget we're on right now. Let's just continue it for seven more weeks, and we'll keep on talking. And the Democrats said, let's add $1.5 trillion in additional costs. Let's fund illegal alien health care, expanded subsidies for Obamacare, and a whole bunch of other garbage, including a long list from John Kennedy of Louisiana, which was hilarious. You know, dance activities for Haitian gay guys and all kinds of crazy stuff that you think was made up by the Babylon Bee. And ChatGPT and the rest of them say, yep, it's clearly the Republicans that are causing this.
Clearly. Never mind. Yeah.
In prior iterations of this kind of these kinds of fights, when a Democrat-controlled House would narrowly pass a bill and shove it down the Senate's throat, and a small majority of Democrats could pass it with, you know, these wishy-washy Republicans that would just go along, like we'd be tied up in knots, wanting them to fight, but they would just get enough Republicans, and the Democrats would just sit back and say, "What's up to the Republicans?" Right, because we have all the votes and we've done our job, and the media would just like clap with like clapping seals, like, well, yeah, it's up to the Republicans, even though they have no power, but they've got to get a couple more votes to keep the government open. How dare the Republicans want to do anything? That's what prior fights would be. Fast forward to today, and somehow the Republicans have to figure out, like, A, what the Democrats want, and B, give them more than what they've ever asked for. In order to keep the trains running on time in this town.
By the way,
I love the traffic break. I really do. The traffic break in Northern Virginia has been awesome, by the way, during the shutdown. So keep it up.
But did you see what Schumer said? Schumer said, this thing is better for us every single day. I mean, I don't know why they think that the public is saying, this is great. You guys should keep on asking for all these things and make all these demands. Otherwise, you're going to vote no and keep the government shut down. And Schumer thinks, at least his perception, is that this is good for them politically. And he appears not to give a damn about whether or not shutting down the entire federal government is good for the public or not.
Well, because he can still find enough of a media apparatus to make him feel warm and fuzzy about his decisions. And not challenge him his decisions. And so he can go not just to the morning Joes of the world. Apparently he can't go to the Washington Post anymore. But he can go to the Blue Sky Brigade, right? And just feel warm and fuzzy about shutting the government down. I'm not a fan of military personnel losing paychecks ever at all. And not even for this. Not a fan of it. Now I would encourage President Trump to be a little bit more. I know he's been busy with the Israeli peace deal, et cetera. But we've got to be a little bit more active about making sure that everyone understands that they're going to get particularly the military is going to get back pay. No problem. No sweat. No drama on that. However, this is a crisis of Democrat creation to try to prop up a bill that has long since failed, to try to give health insurance, not even health care. Okay, let's just be like real about our terminology. It's just health insurance, government-funded insurance, okay, to a whole swath of Americans and non-Americans who either don't need it, okay, or don't deserve it because they're not Americans, okay, and haven't been into the system. And that's just like this government subsidy, this Obamacare premium subsidy that Biden increased by 200% fold.
Yep.
Okay. There are folks around the country who are subscribed to this individual insurance program that are members of country clubs. And the federal government is subsidizing it because, you know, this thing goes upwards of 600% above the poverty line.
Yeah, you can make as much as 500 grand and still qualify. That's David Bozell, the president of the Media Research Center. David, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And Washington State's foolish ferry program puts millions of people who depend on it to a much longer wait because they say they're saving money.
The sound of freedom. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and I invite your phone calls. I got to tell you something. I don't think even the Babylon Bee could imagine a better scenario for the state of Washington to mess up its ferry system. Now, just understand, I don't use the ferry system on a regular basis. I mean, I've used it from time to time, but it's not very often. But there are people who depend on it every single day of the year. So it's about 19 million people use the ferry or take rides on it during any given year in the state of Washington. And the thing has been a mess. Why? Well, because their ferry fleet is aging. It's getting older. And if you say, why don't they replace it? Well, because Jay Inslee decided a long time ago, we can't just replace this with diesel-driven ferries. We've got to have electric ferries. And in fact, they're really diesel electric hybrid ferries. So they're not even purely electric ferries. Thank God. Because can you imagine a ferry entirely dependent on electricity? And then if the batteries go south or something happens, then you've got a real problem. So, Inslee starts the process and it's going to take a long, long time. And now there was a bid that was a couple of $100 million less than a local competitor, a Florida company, managed to say, well, we're going to win the bid, except they're going to get an extra year to be able to deliver it. So as a result, the Washington State company that was going to build them or could have built them, and in fact, I thought the irony was delicious. This same company in Washington State, and I reached out to the company today to see if they'd come on the air. Haven't been able to hear back from them yet. But they're building electric hybrid ferries for San Francisco Bay right now. But then they were passed over to buy the ferries. Instead of buying them anywhere near Washington State, they're going to come from a company in Florida, which is going to build them, except that apparently they're going to be delivered a bit later. They're going to wait a year longer. So you've got an aging ferry fleet that should be replaced or should have been replaced already. So for the first time in more than 50 years, Washington State says we're going to use an out-of-state ship builder about 3,000 miles away to deliver these ferries. We're going to pass over the company in the region that is, in fact, building electric hybrid ferries for the San Francisco Bay Area, and we're going to use Eastern Shipbuilding instead. Eastern Shipbuilding has declined to answer specific questions about why it wanted 5 years to complete the first of those ferries. That would make me suspicious right away. I mean, do you know how to build these ferries? Because we have a company right here that's already building some for San Francisco. And those are apparently our ferries that will carry about 400 people each for San Francisco Bay. Maybe we should have them do it. No, we can do it for you. We'll do it for you cheaper. Watch for change orders on that one. And then they say, but we're going to need 5 years before we deliver the very first boat. Now, if you're one of those people, I'm not, but if you're one of those people who has to use the ferry on a regular basis to get to work or to get home or get to your customers or clients, this is on you. I mean, this is where the state of Washington says, tough luck. You're going to have to stick with the ferries we've already got. The ferry system is notorious for some of its shutdowns and some of its failures, and now you're just going to have to wait longer. The first boat, the contract said, would arrive in 2029, but the contract shows that Eastern Shipbuilding got a delivery date of August 2030 and the second one by August 2031 and the third one the following year, but they say it's going to be cheaper. You know, I wonder, because government contracts are notorious for coming in, low bid on the front end, change orders in the middle, bigger bill when you get to the other end. And if I'm wrong about that, I'll be happy to admit it. Let's go to Stephen. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I think Speaker Johnson might be masking the real issue on the government shutdown, and I need your help. I'm a Republican, right? And I'm a conservative. Okay. I need your help explaining to us that, look, if those subsidies do not pass, all of health care insurance is going to go up. Even for the people on the corporate side, it's going to go up significantly. Now, the message that we're getting, it's not an issue. It's a red herring. The real issue is illegal, you know, providing insurance for illegal immigrants.
That's one of the major issues. It's not the only one. And I'm not going to say that Obamacare subsidies are the only one or illegal alien health care is the only one, but they're all in the mix and they're all hundreds of billions of dollars.
Right. But we're, as Americans, affordability is the big thing right now, economy.
Yep.
And no one wants to see healthcare premiums go up.
But they're going to go up with the subsidy. You understand that even if they vote the subsidies through, premiums are going up. Copays are going up. In fact, I saw NPR the other day, you know, the government, formerly government-funded news organization, a state-controlled media. They were profiling a woman who said right now she's paying $500 a month for her Obamacare. And with the new subsidies, it's going to $2,800 a month. But she has a $10,000 copay or cost sharing. So in other words, imagine paying almost $3,000 a month for health insurance. She's only in her 60s. And then you have to spend about $10,000 out of your own pocket before the health insurance starts to benefit you. Does that sound like Obamacare, which was called the Affordable Care Act, has wrecked health care in America?
Yeah, that helps. But it's almost a no-win for everybody on both sides of the aisle on the subsidies.
Well, the winner is, why do we want dramatically expanded, as was just suggested by Dave Bozell, Biden expanded the subsidies dramatically in 2020 and one in 22. There are people making $500,000 a year who are having subsidized health care provided by the taxpayer. Tell me if you think that's right, yes or no?
No.
No. And that's an easy no. And you say, but now we're going to continue it with more hundreds of billions of dollars, and your premiums are still going up, which I would say is also a no. Stephen, thanks for the call. You got the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and if you've been listening to the show for very long at all, you know that I've been calling for an end to sanctuary policies in the Northwest. Both Oregon and Washington. Oregon, famously in 1987, became the first sanctuary state in the United States. And I think at the time, people thought, well, it's no big deal. It's just a feel-good virtue signaling. And Washington State has done the same. And now major cities have ended up becoming sanctuaries for illegal aliens. Except I think all of us have seen examples over the last couple of years that becoming a sanctuary state for illegal aliens or a sanctuary city puts the population of Americans who live in that city or state at great risk. And so now we've got Washington State Senator Phil Fortunato, who joins me now, who's calling for an end to those sanctuary policies. Senator Fortunato, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Lars. And this is nothing new for me. I mean, this was one of the first bills I did when I got elected to the Senate. I think it was 2018 was the first time I ran a bill. It wasn't sanctuary cities. It was to focus on criminal illegal aliens. And, I mean, it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. I mean, they're looking at doing things for giving illegals in Washington driver's licenses, which makes us a magnet for illegals from all over the country to come to Washington to get a driver's license. The Keep Washington Working Act, which is what people think have something to do with keeping Washingtonians working. Well, what it actually does is protect illegal criminals, and it keeps state agencies and law enforcement from interacting with ICE. I mean, this is just such insanity. It's beyond belief. And these people go and they champion these things like they're with righteous indignation when somebody starts talking about criminal illegal aliens, which is what they're fighting for. And you know, and hell, they shut down the entire United States government over health care for illegals. These people are out of their minds.
They are. And imagine going to voters, and I'm glad the Democrats are doing this to themselves to some extent, because they're going to go to voters in 12 months and they're going to say, or 11 months, and they're going to say, will you vote for me? Put me back in the U.S. Congress. And I hope every single voter out there who's the least bit conservative, even liberals could ask it. So why should I put you back when you voted in favor of giving my taxpayer money to pay for health insurance for illegal aliens? And if you can't explain that, I'm not voting for you.
Well, we have two special elections in Washington. We're five votes behind in the Senate. We have two special elections for senators in Washington State. Now, that would reduce the majority that the Democrats have, sending a signal. So if anybody is in the Gig Harbor area, in the Kitsap area, I think it's the 26th district or in the 5th district, you need to make sure you send a message that you do not tolerate this craziness and vote Republican. I mean, cut me a break. The House of Representatives, the chairman of the House of Representatives, state government and tribal relations committee has a hearing on the Keep Washington Working Act. Now, you would think that that would be, hey, what can we do to modify this bill to be in compliance with federal law? Instead, they're looking at it, what can we do to strengthen this bill so that we can go up against the feds and protect illegal criminals? This is madness. And, our GOP chair is also a state rep. And, he gets up there and he says, these guys are conflating illegal immigration with legal immigration.
And they are.
And my parents are off the boat Italians. I'm a first generation American. My parents didn't teach me Italian because they wanted me to be American. And, I don't get it.
No, I don't get it either. Tuesday, when Secretary Noem was in Portland. And while she's there, ICE manages to bag an illegal alien who is then charged with sexual crimes against children. And you say, do you give a damn about that? Do you wonder why there's a really disproportionate number of illegal aliens who commit sexual crimes against little girls? I mean, if that hasn't occurred to you, think about that for a moment, and then think about the different cultural standards in places south of the border.
No, I've been doing this a long time, and I got a list from ICE on the number of people that they have identified in state prisons that has now increased from 300 to over 500. But a majority of those, out of 300, 130 of them at the time were sexual abuse crimes, like murder, rapists and horrible things with children. And these are the people that they are protecting. And then they run around and proclaim that they want to protect children while they're putting women and children mostly at risk. Never mind the people that they're murdering. I mean, this is crazy. And who do they think the primary victims of illegal criminals are? Other illegals. So they're not even protecting, quote, the illegal community.
No, they're not. Phil, we've got a guy
in bizarro world.
We've got a guy in my audience, David Cross. And David, for more than a decade, decided to take it on his own to track the number of illegals in the region. And then he went to the Departments of Corrections of Oregon and Washington, and he said, I want to figure out how many of the people you have locked up and convicted of crimes like rape and murder are illegal aliens. About 4-5% of the state populations of Oregon and Washington are illegal aliens. It is that big a number. But then you look at, well, what percentage of the convicted killers are illegals? And it's 14%, almost three times as many. And when it comes to rapists, it's 18%. And if that doesn't draw a picture, when you've got a tiny fraction of the population who are here illegally, who don't seem to mind going out and committing murder or committing rape, and you say, well, that's a made-up number. I said, no, that's a number straight from the Department of Corrections. So the illegal alien crowd, as Trump warned us 10 years ago in 2015 when he announced, when illegals come here, they're not saying their best. And you're right about them conflating the terms, saying, this is a migrant who came here and got a green card and jumped through all the hoops. This is a migrant who came here completely illegally, would be like calling a crack, cocaine, or fentanyl salesperson a pharmacist. And you say, well, they're pharmacists. They're all pharmacists. They all deal in drugs. You know, the guy at the Walgreens,
yeah,
the guy at the CVS.
That one. That's great.
And the guy down on the corner who's selling fentanyl, they're all pharmacists. One is just an undocumented pharmacist. And when they mix those two groups together, then they say, look how law-abiding immigrants are. Well, people who hold green cards are very law-abiding because if you break the law, you lose your green card and you get a boot out of the country. If you're an illegal alien and you break the law, you can run back to Mexico or some other country and simply come back when the heat has cooled off. That is Senator Phil Fortunato, representing the 31st District in the State Senate. Phil, thank you very much. In a moment, Democrat Katie Porter of California says her 12-year-old daughter cried over Donald Trump's victory because she was worried about not being able to get an abortion. And this woman may be the odds-on favorite to become the next governor of California. If you thought Gavin Newsom was bad...
Be honest. You're listening because you like what you hear. Right? Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to talk about Katie Porter. Now, Katie Porter is a Democrat, and she's a little bit of a crazy woman, member of Congress, and boy, she has every bit of the reputation that says that if she is your boss, you are going to get abused. And apparently there are plenty of videos that show exactly that, except that right now she appears to be one of the leading candidates, if not the leading Democrat, to become the next governor of the state of California. And she is campaigning hard, except that she's kind of crazy. I mean, we've talked about the fact that she blew up in an interview with the CBS affiliate in California. And why did she blow up? Because she was asked what is kind of a garden variety regular question that you ask of candidates. She'd been very, very critical of Donald Trump. I kind of expect that out of almost every Democrat these days. But Katie Porter, she has doubled down and then doubled down again. And she was asked this reasonable question. We played the soundbite the other day where a reporter from a TV station in Sacramento, CBS TV station, so probably not the most conservative reporter in the world, asked her, what are you going to say to the 6 million people in California who voted for Donald Trump? Now, California won big time for Kamala Harris. I understand that. But you do have to confront that. If you're running for office in a given area, even if you are very confident that you'll be able to get the votes, you do have to say, if you're running for the spot of governor of the state, you've got to serve all of the people of that state. Well, apparently not if you're Katie Porter, because Katie Porter's answer was, I don't need him. I don't need them. Why would I? I've never needed them before. Well, problem is, she's not running for a congressional district anymore. She's running for governor of the entire state. But apparently, she didn't like that, so the reporter asked a follow-up question. And then at that point, Katie Porter blew up. She got angry. I mean, this is the woman who has done some psycho things, like she showed up for one of the impeachment votes of Donald Trump, wearing a Batwoman costume of some kind in Congress. She was a member of Congress, and she shows up wearing this Halloween costume in the United States Congress. At one point, her divorce documents indicate that she dumped a whole pan full of boiling potatoes on top of her husband's head. And, of course, there are any number of videos online. I'm going to play some audio from one of them in just a moment. But the first one was after Donald Trump's victory, the night that Donald Trump won the 2024 election last fall. She was asked about, well, how is this going to affect America? And she told this crazy story about her 12-year-old daughter. Take a listen to it.
So on election night, I went to pick up my daughter from water polo practice, and she's 12, and she got in the car and she was crying. And I said, did someone punch you? Like, water polo is a rough sport. Yeah. I was like, did someone hit you? Did the coach yell at you? What happened? And she said, Mom, Trump won. Trump's going to win. And what if I get raped and I need to have an abortion? This is from a 12-year-old, my 12-year-old daughter.
Now, what's crazy about that is you kind of wonder, where did this 12-year-old get the idea, number one, that she might be raped, but number two, that if she got raped, she would get pregnant, and then she would be unable to obtain an abortion. Her mom lives in California. The girl lives in California. I mean, the Supreme Court of the United States overturned Roe v. Wade, famously, but then said, this is up to the states. So there are states where it is very difficult to get any kind of abortion. Idaho would be one of those. I applaud Idaho for that. In California, you are guaranteed that unless California changes its very, very liberal stripes that it's had in the last couple of decades, there's no way in the world that an abortion is going to be unobtainable in that state. And then you got to wonder how much of this thought of her 12-year-old daughter is coming from the 12-year-old on her own. I mean, I suppose it's entirely possible that a 12-year-old might be involved enough in politics to be reading about all the issues and all the charges by the Democrats. So, well, if Donald Trump gets elected, abortion will become illegal. Has it become illegal? In the states where the states have decided to make it illegal, like Idaho, like a few other states, yes. In states like California, I mean, if she's politically aware, then she must be aware that California is going to make sure that abortion on demand is the law of the land. It's at least within the confines of California, Oregon, Washington, New York, a number of other liberal states. They're always going to have abortion. But then you have to wonder about this, because Katie Porter over and over and over again has blown up at her staffers. And many of these blow-ups are caught on video. And why? Because Katie Porter is doing a video of some kind or doing a live video presentation or a Zoom call with somebody. Here's an example of one of them, and we had to use a few beeps in here to take out some very, very unladylike language from Member of Congress Katie Porter.
And what it showed is if we don't electrify our transportation sector, that we're going to lose more than 500,000 Californians dying prematurely to air pollution and other problems, and the state could lose four. Get out of my f***ing shot.
I wanted to tell you that that's actually incorrect. It's not that it's electric vehicles. It's that if we don't meet the commitments under the Paris Climate Accord.
Okay. It does. Okay. You also were in my shot before that. Stay out of my shot.
Now, I'm trying to ask, I'm trying to wonder. This is a member of Congress. Now, being a member of Congress is not exactly heavy lifting. If you decide not to show up for votes, there are a lot of members of Congress who do that. If you decide to never introduce a meaningful piece of legislation, you can still hang on to your job. There are plenty of people in both the Senate and the House who don't introduce much in the way of legislation. They don't show up for many of the votes. Sometimes they don't show up for very many votes at all. But yelling at your staff because somebody got in your shot, and then to find out that the staffer was merely trying to make sure that the member of Congress did not say something that was completely inaccurate. In that case, it happened to be something about climate change and environmental regulations and electric vehicles. But rather than thanking this member of her staff for helping keep her accurate on the air, I mean, I would hope that, you know, I thank my producers all the time. There are times I make mistakes, and I do. And I try to let you know when I've made a mistake on the air, we correct it. But if I start screaming and yelling at people because they helped correct something, stay out of my shot. You stay out of my shot. I mean, she's starting to sound like some of the craziest people on the left. But in any case, that's what she was doing. And does this person have the temperament to be the next governor of the state of California? Well, after she had that blow up with the reporter from Sacramento from the CBS station, where she didn't want to answer a perfectly ordinary question. What are you going to say to 6 million voters that voted for Donald Trump and they're not going to think much of you? Now, you'd think that most candidates who have run for any kind of office, let alone run for Congress and are now running for governor, would have some kind of canned answer at least. I mean, even if they can't think on their feet very well, you'd say, well, I'm going to go out and serve all of the people of the state I'm running for governor in. Instead, her response is, I don't need those people. I've never needed those people. I've got enough Democrats to be able to win the election, and I don't have to pay any attention to them. And she's asking to be the governor of the state. I mean, even if you're a left-wing liberal Democrat, are you going to vote for somebody with that kind of temperament to be the chief executive of one of the most prosperous states and one of the biggest population states in the United States? Are you going to vote for her? Well, right after that blow-up interview, she lost about 40 points in the political opinion poll. So maybe this will be a problem that will correct itself and she simply will lose the election. I think it's going to be hilarious because the Democrats don't know what to do with Katie Porter. Glad to have you with me. If you want to jump into the conversation, it's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest
Network. The Lars Larson Show. Simply by listening, you're proving how smart you really are. Lars thanks you.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. Well, the more time goes on, the more we find out about the activities of what I've always called the Biden crime family. Joe Biden's son, Hunter, allegedly pushed a risky real estate deal in Romania while Joe Biden was vice president. Could this have put U.S. embassy land into the hands of foreign ownership? Well, Kenneth Vogel is a reporter for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and the author of Devil's Advocates, the hidden story of Rudy Giuliani, Hunter Biden, and the Washington insiders on the payrolls of corrupt foreign interests. Mr. Vogel, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Lars.
My audience has heard a lot about Hunter Biden. We've talked about his issues a lot. And, of course, he has a federal pardon. which lets him out of any federal prosecution for all crimes past and present, and I guess future. What was the deal he was working on in Romania?
Yeah, this is actually kind of similar in some ways to the situation that everyone is so familiar with in Ukraine, where Hunter Biden went to work both in Ukraine and Romania for an oligarch who was the target of an anti-corruption prosecution that was backed by his father's government when his father was vice president. And let's not forget that one of the sort of main pillars of Joe Biden's track record, or at least his sort of view of himself, was like as an international statesman who went around the world urging our allies to fight corruption. Well, in both these cases, Ukraine and Romania, Hunter Biden was working for someone and getting handsomely paid to do so, who would have been, who was prosecuted under this, under these anti-corruption pushes. So in Ukraine, we know it was the Burisma, the gas company, where Joe Biden urged the firing of the prosecutor for allegedly not investigating it. But in Romania, it was this real estate magnate who had purchased a bunch of land from the state, sort of similar oligarchic fact pattern, where it's someone who is getting rich because they are, because of their connections to a former communist state, and he had built this huge development on it. Well, one of the tenants on the development was none other than the U.S. government, which was renting space there for the U.S. embassy in Bucharest. Hunter Biden tried to get the Romanian real estate developer out of the prosecution, essentially killing the case, pressuring the U.S. government to try to kill the case, and then subsequently tried to enlist his Chinese benefactors, this is CEFC, this Chinese government-linked company, to buy a part of the land in this contested parcel, with the thinking being, A, it would put a bunch of money in Hunter Biden's pocket, and B, it would potentially kill the case that the Romanian prosecutors were bringing against this Romanian real estate magnate.
Now, in this case, did the fact that his father was the vice president of the United States play a role in Hunter Biden even being involved in this deal? Can we draw a connection there?
Absolutely. The Romanian real estate developer who hired Hunter Biden initially, I should say, as a lawyer. Hunter Biden is a Yale-educated lawyer at the time. He was of counsel at a big law firm with offices in Washington and New York, Boies Schiller. And so this real estate developer brought in Hunter Biden's firm because he thought that Hunter Biden would be able to use his name and his connections to urge the U.S. government to back the Romanian prosecutors away from this case targeting the real estate magnate. You can take my word for it in my reporting, or you can actually look at the charging documents or one of the filings in the case that the tax fraud case that prosecutors brought against Hunter Biden, because they actually at one point warn him and say, hey, you know, we're not charging you with violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act, but we could because of your work for this Romanian real estate developer. And they outright said that the Romanian real estate developer had hired Hunter in order to back down the U.S. government and get the U.S. government to back down the Romanian prosecutors.
I got to tell you, Kenneth, I was a reporter a long time, and it always frustrated me because back then you'd do something in a story and say, documents say, and there was no way to actually put a link in there like you can today and just say to your audience, hey, you want to read the whole document? There it is. And you can decide whether or not I've quoted it accurately or not. These days you can. So did Joe Biden know that this was going on?
Well, he says that he didn't. And, we don't really have any documentary evidence that he was aware. However, we do know, thanks to the Republican congressional investigations and some of the witnesses that came forward in that, that Hunter Biden did in fact introduce his father to the Chinese investors who would have been a part of this land deal that would have potentially, let's think about this, Laura. It's like this land deal, if it would have gone through, which it didn't, it could have resulted in the Chinese owning not just the land around the U.S. embassy, but potentially the land on which the U.S. embassy sat.
And CEFC, this is the company that later, correct me if I'm wrong, paid millions of dollars to Hunter Biden and his partners?
Correct. And they were already paying Hunter Biden's partners at the time when this was being pursued. They didn't ultimately pay into the fund that would have been the beneficiary of this land deal that Hunter was pushing. But they had paid him already at that point. And this was part of what he was supposed to be bringing to them, is these investment opportunities. And another key thing to keep in mind here is, like, you know, one of Hunter Biden's partners who we talked to for this story said, you know, defended this by saying it was quite common at that time, being 2016, 2017, for, you know, in the U.S. and the EU, for, you know, investors to see, or sorry, businesses to seek Chinese investment. And that may be true, but this company, CEFC, was a critical cog in the Chinese government's Belt and Road Initiative, which was the economic influence initiative wherein they used investments like this to get into these countries and make themselves indispensable and also build political ties. So in some ways, and I've seen some reporting, I don't report this directly, but there was a story in Yahoo by an acclaimed reporter, Michael Isikoff, that pointed out the sort of parallels between this effort by CEFC to use Hunter Biden and its economic influence initiative to some of the stuff that they did in other countries that was the result that resulted in U.S. prosecutions for bribery and sort of improper, you know, political influence.
Hey, Ken, have you figured out why Hunter Biden, I mean, before his pardon, was never charged under FARA? Because he clearly was acting on behalf of a whole bunch of foreign entities, the widow of the mayor of Moscow in Kazakhstan, in Ukraine, and now Romania and China. Why they never brought charges against him?
I mean, you know, to be sort of charitable, there was the there were statute of limitations issues with some of this stuff being as far back as like 2014. However, they had told, you know, where the prosecutors reach agreements with the defense attorneys to essentially extend the statute of limitations in order to, you know, pursue an investigation and maybe a plea deal. So, like, maybe that was going on. Maybe that's a part of it. But it's hard to ignore the political reality that it would be explosive politically were the Justice Department to charge the former vice president and future president.
Except the part that I've never understood, Ken, is while Biden was vice president and then later while Biden was president, I kind of get that. But in the intervening years in between when he wasn't vice president or president, what is this shield that seemed to exist around all the Biden family's activities?
Well, let's not forget, Lars, that by the time that this federal investigation into Hunter was really going strong, Joe Biden was already eyeing, if not actually declared, as a candidate for president in 2020. So I take your point, but there would still be the political ramifications because it would result in a situation where a leading candidate, if not the nominee for, Democrat nominee for president, where his son was being charged of being an unregistered foreign agent.
See, which I think fits well because Biden always said, I wasn't going to run for president. And then all of a sudden he does. And you wonder, could he have had an alternate motive? Like, if I run for president, then they're going to have to hold off any kind of prosecution. You could read the entire story. Ken Vogel is a reporter for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and the author of Devil's Advocate. Mr. Vogel, thanks so much. I appreciate the time. We'll look forward to talking to you again. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Think of him as your concealed carry. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, live on the Radio Northwest Network, covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and trying to do justice to all three states. If you want to join the best conversation and talk journalism, it's right here every day. And boy, a lot of developments today. Number one, Letitia James. Yeah, the Attorney General in the state of New York has now been brought up on charges of mortgage fraud. And isn't that kind of ironic? Because of her case against Donald Trump, and a case that's largely gone now, but Letitia James apparently involved herself in mortgage fraud, at least according to the indictment. We'll see how that one plays out. In the Middle East, Hamas has now agreed to the deal to release hostages, to have a ceasefire, and eventually an end to the war, and that's apparently been agreed to by the leadership of Hamas. And in Washington, D.C., at the cabinet meeting this morning, in fact, Joel, do we still have that soundbite? the soundbite of the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, and she's at a big table, a cabinet meeting table, and Donald Trump has these cabinet meetings. He doesn't, like Joe Biden, have to turn it over to his wife to run the meeting because Joe's too out of it to actually be able to do that. No, Trump's sitting right there, and Kristi Noem details her visit to Portland, in which she went to the ICE headquarters. She met with the mayor and the governor, and she met with the state police. She calls them the highway patrol, but state police in Oregon. And she also met with the governor, mayor, state police, and the police chief of Portland. And she basically says all of them are liars, that they say one thing behind closed doors and then go out publicly and say something different. I want you to hear what she had to say, because there's an interesting tidbit in there that I want you to take note of.
And then I was in Portland, went out and back on Tuesday, and met with the governor, met with the mayor, met with the chief of police and the superintendent of the highway patrol. They are all lying and disingenuous and dishonest people, because as soon as you leave the room, then they make the exact opposite response. So we're looking at new facilities to purchase. They're in Portland, too, and we're going to double down. And I told them if they didn't meet our demands for safety and security on the streets and work with us, then we were going to bring in more federal law enforcement.
In fact, she said that she would quadruple the number of federal law enforcement officers on the ground. And I think even Portland realizes they may be able to take Donald Trump to court on bringing in the National Guard, federalizing the National Guard in Oregon, and then using them to back up the federal law enforcement at the ICE headquarters. They can't do anything about Donald Trump using federal law enforcement in this case. And I'll point something else out. The other thing that happened today is that because Portland and Oregon went to court and they sued the Trump administration and said, you shouldn't be in control of the National Guard and you can't use the National Guard in Portland. Well, a federal judge in Portland then almost immediately said, yes, I'm going to take away control of the National Guard from President Trump, and I'm going to stop him from deploying them in Portland. Well, guess what happened? The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, that's the big federal appeals court that's located in San Francisco, they heard arguments today about whether or not, number one, Donald Trump is in charge of the National Guard. And the federal appeals court disagreed with the lower court judge and said, yeah, the president of the United States can federalize the National Guard. He's in charge of the National Guard. He has that authority. Now, I'm sure that disappointed a lot of people at Portland City Hall and probably even Mahonia Hall, where the governor makes her home. But there's a second thing that happened. They heard the arguments today from both sides. And it sounds like based on their questions, they're going to side with Donald Trump. They're going to say that not only does Trump have the power to federalize the National Guard, call them up, but also to deploy them in Portland. So I'm giving you fair warning that when that happens, when they finally issue a decision, and if I had to guess, it'll probably be either tomorrow night, Friday night, or it'll be over the weekend. They'll want it to happen when they're safely out of their chambers. I think the federal court, the federal appeals court, is going to decide in favor of Donald Trump. It'll be one more win. He has a string of wins at the Supreme Court. He has a string of wins at the appeals courts. I mean, there's always much ado by the mainstream media and politicians about all the lower court judges, which make all these crazy decisions involving Donald Trump. But when it comes to the Supreme Court, he has 17 wins in a row. I'm sorry, he has 15 wins in a row, 17 wins this year. So there was a break. He lost one or two. But for the most part, Trump has been winning at the Supreme Court, which at the end of the day is the only court that really matters. And he's been winning a lot in the Court of Appeals. And I think that when he wins in this case, and the Ninth Circuit's Court of Appeals is forced because of the law to say the president is in charge of the National Guard, and the president, yes, can send the National Guard to Portland, that a lot of people, including Tina Kotek and Keith Wilson and Chief Bob Day from Portland and the state police are going to have egg on their faces. They're going to have made the case to the public, Trump can't do this. And then one of the craziest liberal courts in America, the Ninth Circuit's Court of Appeals in San Francisco, is going to say, oh, no, as a matter of fact, he does have the right to do that. And when that happens, I predict the left is going to absolutely lose its mind. They're going to run around like their hair is on fire. They're going to be saying, no, he can't do this. And then when Kristi Noem sends more federal law enforcement, the other shoe that will drop is this one. She said they're looking for other property to buy. See, they don't own the ICE headquarters they're in. They only lease it. And one of Christy Noem's asks of Portland was, why don't you take over the lease and we'll move somewhere else? But then when they buy the somewhere else, I think it's going to be fantastic. If they buy another property and then they own the property and they have the right to use that property, again, I think the left is going to lose its mind in the city of Portland. Glad to be with you and live on the Radio Northwest Network. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.